From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. With the news-making cell phone video recorded by 31-year-old would-be passenger John Tyner at the San Diego airport, when, confronting new invasive body scanners, he opted for the new hands-on pat-down procedures instead and learned they'd be going for his groin.
And if you'd like a private screening, we can make that available for you also.
We can do that out here, but if you touch my junk, I'm going to have you arrested.
When faced with the inevitability of junk touching, he balked again and was told his final option would be to leave the airport.
Okay, I don't understand how a sexual assault can be made a condition of my flying.
This is not considered a sexual assault.
It would be if you weren't the government.
Then he learned that leaving wasn't an option either. He had to submit to a pat-down or risk an $11,000 Transportation Safety Agency fine. He still declined. But his cell phone video, posted online, quickly went viral. Now several groups have called for a national opt-out day on November 24th, the year's single biggest travel day. Has the internet pushed America to the brink of a transportation rebellion? Mika Sifri is co-founder of the Personal Democracy Forum and TechPresident.com. He says opposition to the new scanners and pat-downs have made for some strange bedfellows.
We see groups from the right, like Congressman Ron Paul, groups like the ACLU, which is traditionally thought of as being more on the left, all talking about whether the TSA has gone too far, and a lot of bottom-up spontaneous activity that the internet is so great at fostering.
Now, the TSA has prided itself on being responsive to air travelers, especially via the internet.
Yeah, the TSA was one of the first federal government agencies to start blogging, and we have to give them some credit for really using the TSA blog as a place where air travelers could get answers to their questions and also could vent off some steam. What is curious about the way the TSA is responding right now, actually, for a couple of days, they shut off comments on their blog because they were getting so many negative ones, and they continue to make statements that seem pretty tone deaf. As I wrote in my blog post, people are worried about terrorism, to be sure, but they don't like to be molested sexually in public either.
Yeah, but as of Monday, the vast majority of Americans seem to be fine with these new scanners. A CBS poll found that 81% of people preferred the new X-ray scanners to the invasive pat-downs. So this looks like a great case to see what the ability of the internet is to move the masses. There seems to be a division.
As you know, it's all in how you phrase the question to get the kind of answer that might tilt one way or the other. Secondly, not every American has experienced what these new procedures are like. But that said, I have my doubts about whether all this online hustle and bustle over this issue, which is sincere, will really convert into civil disobedience. I don't think they're yet organized well enough to make anything change.
In your blog post, you cited Malcolm Gladwell's recent piece in The New Yorker in which he argues that the internet creates only weak ties and that they aren't strong enough to sustain real activism. For instance, the civil rights movement couldn't have been fomented online because it required a far greater commitment than just clicking like on your computer.
Well, I think the mistake that Malcolm Gladwell made in his piece was arguing that this was an either-or choice between the strong bonds that were forged in movements like the civil rights movement and the weak ties that somebody has when they like something on Facebook. Yeah, but weak ties may lead to stronger ties. And so the unanswered question about this current wave of concern is whether all these scattered individuals who are linking up virtually will decide that they actually have to form real-life affinity groups to act in particular places at particular times. That's how weak ties can lead to stronger ties that can lead to real change. And we are in a very early moment. It could be that November 24th's opt-out day is a bust, but the fact is that this story isn't going away. The TSA seems to have no interest in backing down. They believe they need these new procedures. The other reason is that this is catnip to the media. I mean, what other story combines terrorism and sex? The cable shows and talk radio are going to be all over this for months.
But, Mika, it's very hard to test the power of the internet without factoring in the amplifying effect of the story crossing over to other media.
No one has ever argued that the internet enhances people's power all by itself. That said, it is worth noting that John Tyner did something courageous and unusual in videotaping his own experience and posting it online. And last I checked, it's been viewed 750,000 times. This is a great example of how the net empowers individuals to put an issue higher up on the agenda than political actors or political organizations might have done on their own.
Do you see something special in this TSA flap, something that we can learn from if we're interested in what the potential is for change online?
I think it's part of a continuing unfolding of what it means to live in an age where we're all hyper-networked. The part that interests me most about the rest of the story, which we don't know the end of yet, is whether some group of organizers will figure out how to convert this online anger over this issue into action on the ground that actually can snarl up the TSA's behavior and force the political system to respond.
Mika, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Brooke.
Mika Sifri is co-founder and editor of the Personal Democracy Forum and TechPresident.com.
It's the clash of the internet titans, the battle royale of web behemoths, the showdown in whatever. It's Facebook versus Google.
Facebook thinks it might have revolutionized messaging.
The social networking site unveiling a one-stop shop for instant messages, text messages, Facebook messages, and emails.
The people at Facebook have named it the Gmail killer.
This week, Facebook announced Facebook Messages. Business Week called it, quote, nothing less than a revolutionary bid to make Facebook our personal communications hub. Dan Gilmore of the Knight Center for Digital Media Entrepreneurship, on the other hand, said the prospect of Facebook capturing his identity online was, quote, not just disturbing, but dangerous. Dan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with what this is, Facebook Messages. Email, instant messaging, mobile texts, I guess Facebook wall posts, all streaming onto your page. Can you describe what it looks like to the user?
If you set it up the way they are suggesting, you have three essential buckets for information. One is the people you know on Facebook and the people they know, friends and friends of friends. Then there's a category of other. For example, my bank is not my friend. And if a message from my bank came in, it would go into the other bucket. And then there's a third one called spam, which is exactly what it sounds like. I've only just started to play with it. They're rolling this out very slowly, and I've been given one of the early accounts to try it. And it's quite interesting. But as you noted, I'm skeptical in many ways.
Tell me what frightens you about this.
Kind of a long-standing issue that I and many others have had with Facebook is I think their casual approach to privacy, despite their pronouncements. In this case, they're going to archive everything that you do. You're going to have to go and delete stuff.
You mean all of my emails, messages from other platforms, rational and irrational, tasteful and distasteful, safe for work and unsafe at any speed, all of it stays on Mark Zuckerberg's servers in perpetuity?
My understanding is if you have decided to import everything into your Facebook messaging, that all of these conversations that you have will be saved for posterity, police, and divorce lawyers. I think a default should be that you archive it if you want to, and not that it's something you have to unarchive. And keep in mind, everything we say is, for Facebook, data that is useful in part for selling advertisers.
But apart from privacy, you have other concerns as well.
And that is that Facebook has a very strong interest in having you spend as much time inside of Facebook as your primary place of doing stuff when you're online. I want people to experience a broad and increasingly diverse and interesting internet and not to get pulled into the walled gardens that others are creating.
I myself use Gmail and I have a Google homepage with all of my news feeds set up and so forth and so on. And it's an enormous nuisance to change platforms. If I'm to embrace Facebook Messages, do I have to move my life from Google to Facebook, or can I simply send my Gmail into the Facebook stream?
As far as I know, you can forward anything you want into the Facebook stream. It's fascinating because a lot of people use Gmail to do exactly that with their other email. But I have to say, I've done neither of those two and plan to do neither of those two. I think you need your own home base on the internet that is controlled by you to the extent that such things are controllable, and not by some large enterprise that can make decisions down the road that you might not agree with and then leave you scrambling to do something different.
So you have dangilmore.com?
I do.
And what do you sacrifice by being the master of your own domain?
Well, I sacrifice a little bit of money because I have to pay for it. I sacrifice some of the truly wonderful manipulating of email tools, using manipulating in the best way, that you can get with some of the providers that are all up in the cloud online like Gmail. But I have my own online presence that is my frame of reference about myself. And one of the things that we don't remember often enough is that people who are not particularly savvy about technology but just want to use things, they tend to accept whatever service is there based on what the provider has put in their face. So Facebook's decisions are going to have huge influence on how a lot of people communicate, and I'm in absolute awe of the technical brilliance of that company and the vision as well, but I do stay quite concerned about where they're leading us.
Well, maybe I'll split the difference. Maybe I'll leave Gmail, not go to Facebook Messages, but what I want is for my email address to be bob@dangilmore.com.
I'll set it up later. However, I make no representations for privacy.
Dan, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Dan Gilmore is director of the Knight Center for Digital Media Entrepreneurship.
Coming up, a bad smell emanates from the Washington Post's cash cow.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The Washington Post Company includes the Post newspaper, a half dozen other papers, six TV stations, a cable company and internet service provider, Slate.com, and until recently, Newsweek magazine. What you probably know is that the Washington Post itself is unprofitable. What you perhaps did not know was that 75% of its profits come from a non-media business, the Kaplan Education subsidiary, a leader in the burgeoning for-profit higher education industry, along with such competitors as University of Phoenix and DeVry. Kaplan offers college and vocational training courses to mainly disadvantaged students, financed mainly by federal student loans. But recently, Kaplan has come under fire for recruiting students unlikely to complete coursework and doing so with exaggerated promises of financial success. This is problematic on its own, but at least as concerning is the blurring of lines between the newspaper's influence and reputation and the cash cow keeping it afloat. Tamer Lewin wrote about this overlap for the New York Times. Tamer, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Briefly explain the general set of allegations against Kaplan and who's making them.
There are five different whistleblower suits from different parts of the country involving different Kaplan branches.
And the whistleblowers are former employees for the most part.
Yes, and some quite high up. But all of them have in common some kinds of allegation that in their quest for profits, they're manipulating their data, they're breaking laws on how they pay their recruiters, they're keeping students on the books too long in order to keep their aid, misdeeds that the whistleblowers say amounts to fraud. So besides that, there's several different things going on in the federal government. Senator Harkin, who's the chairman of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, has had a set of hearings, and they're continuing. And in the course of that, they sent GAO investigators undercover to visit a bunch of for-profit colleges to tape them with hidden cameras. And what they came away with from every single one of the 15 places they visited was at least deception and at most outright fraud. Two of those were Kaplan ones. Another big thing that's going on is the Department of Education has proposed some new rules that would stop federal funding completely to any for-profit program if 45% of their students weren't repaying their loans. And that would hurt Kaplan because in August they were 28%. And the University of Phoenix was at 44%. So they had a bad showing even compared to a lot of other for-profits.
Now, the Post Company has responded to a lot of these allegations, chalking them up variously to long discontinued practices or to abuses from a handful of low-level employees. You spoke to CEO Don Graham himself, but I didn't get the impression from your piece that you think his explanations scan. Am I right about that?
Well, he makes the case that this is a wonderful thing and does a lot of good for very poor students. And I'm sure that there are some for whom that's true. But what was very troubling was I talked to dozens and dozens of students and employees, and the pattern was so consistent. Recruiters who actually left because they felt the practices were so unsavory, and students who ended up with heaps and heaps of debt and nothing useful in the way of a certificate or a degree. So, no, I guess it's fair to say I wasn't convinced by him. I really don't think it would be fair to say this was a little group of outliers, because that's not what I found.
Now, there are several things in your reporting that raised my eyebrows and so forth. One was the invocation by Kaplan recruiters, the salespeople basically, of the Washington Post newspaper and of some of the parent company's famous name board members, Warren Buffett, Melinda Gates, and so on. This has been documented?
I heard it from quite a lot of different recruiters. I think it would be kind of odd that recruiters in different cities would all say, yes, they were trained to say, if you have any doubts about Kaplan, you should know that Warren Buffett and Melinda Gates, Bill Gates' wife, are on our board, and would they do anything bad? And one recruiter in Florida told me they used to get dinged if they didn't say that, and then after the scrutiny started, they were told they shouldn't say it anymore, and they got dinged if they did say it. And as you probably know, Melinda Gates, she resigned 2 days after the story ran.
Do we have any reason to believe this is a coincidence?
I don't have any reason to believe that it's a coincidence.
Okay, a second concern is that Donald Graham, the CEO and chairman of the Washington Post Company, has been lobbying on Capitol Hill in person and via paid lobbyists to counter legislation or regulation targeting the for-profit education industry.
I do think there are real questions about how much clout a person like Donald Graham has when he goes to Capitol Hill. He said he hasn't gone to the Hill to lobby personally on anything in at least a dozen years. And it's an entirely different thing than when a for-profit college president generally would go. Nobody in Washington wants the Washington Post against him. It's a horrifying thought. And NPR's own Cokie Roberts, who certainly knows her Congress, said that Congress really isn't likely to go ahead and do that much about for-profits because Democrats would be too fearful of hurting the Washington Post.
Now, one thing that the Post could do if it were concerned about the appearance of conflict would be to waive editorial coverage of the controversy within the for-profit education industry.
I think it's been substantially less than most other major papers have done. It's been careful, but they have had some. Their ombudsman has said, bravo, what a fine job the paper is doing of declaring its conflict and going ahead with the coverage. I don't share that bravo.
All right. But meantime, the Post has editorialized against legislative overreaction to the problem, if any, with the for-profits. Publishers are certainly entitled to flog their interests in their editorials, but it does seem to be the crossing of some line there, no?
They can editorialize about anything they want. But, you know, it's noticeable that the LA Times and the New York Times would editorialize for this regulation and say we have a real problem and this is a way to attack it. And the Washington Post would say, no, no, this is a terrible idea and it's going to do terrible things.
Newspapers are under siege. And, you know, I'm a subscriber. I get that paper every day. I don't want anything to happen to it, but I also don't want to feel dirty wondering how this fantastic reporting has been subsidized. As a reader, what's my stake in this?
Well, I think you should be thinking about the fact that it's not okay to let the Washington Post reputation paper over trouble in the unit that's providing their money. For-profit college students are 11% of the students, but 43% of the ones who default. And this is a debt that is not dischargeable in bankruptcy. It's going to follow these students for the rest of their lives. And if they're not going to succeed and they're being encouraged to take out big loans for programs that they either won't finish or won't really help them in their careers, there's something worrisome going on.
All right. Tamar, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tamar Lewin is an education reporter for The New York Times. We contacted the Post Company for comment, and it offered a statement that also ran in the November 17th New York Times. Nowhere in the New York Times story, the statement says, quote, is there any mention of learning, though that's what keeps students coming to Kaplan Higher Education and has launched 275,000 graduates into better lives and careers. Kaplan has brought innovation and excellence to a population of largely low-income students who don't usually have access to either, and the results are striking. Our graduation rates for the higher-risk population we serve are 15 percentage points higher than the national average for comparable students, and we do it at a taxpayer cost less than half that of traditional institutions. Rather than focusing on the questionable complaints of a handful of serial plaintiffs, the article should have focused on how institutions like Kaplan are bringing new choices to underserved students, complementing a traditional higher education system that is straining to keep up with the economy's need for a more educated workforce. Signed, Andy Rosen, Chairman and Chief Executive, Kaplan, Inc. Once again, however, Donald Graham, the CEO of the Washington Post Company, declined our offer to respond personally.
Some stories seem almost too big to cover, so you start with an anecdote, such as, on May 16th, 7-year-old Ayanna Stanley Jones was killed sitting on her couch by a stray police bullet during a midnight raid in search of her father, a murder suspect. The police used overwhelming force and a stun grenade, even though the door was unlocked. But in this case, the police were accompanied by a reality TV camera crew, and so a tragic inference could be drawn. Journalist Charlie LaDuff used Ayanna's death as a way into a long, devastating depiction of his city of Detroit for Mother Jones magazine. He's seen the press come and go. Most recently, they've been coming, writing reams and leaving. But he suggests all those words still miss the point of the big story. Charlie, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I love your show.
Thanks. Do you think that the fact that a TV crew was in tow encouraged the police to violate their own procedures, as apparently they did, in creating a more dramatic entrance than they needed to?
Yeah. Talking to a high-ranking police source here, in his many, many years in the business, he's never used a grenade to apprehend a suspect. And so it is quite possible. We'll find out, I guess, when this thing eventually gets to court, whether they were playing up to the cameras. And the funny thing about that is, this is many months later, and there's been no report released, no official word from the state police, the Detroit police, anybody. It's kind of sad in a way. I mean, Detroit's misery, it's really selling. We have a couple of TV shows, we have a couple of reality shows, a slew of documentaries. So we're in the media spotlight. But none of it really much amounts to anything in terms of helping the community.
But Detroit's been a mess for at least half a century. Is it the collapse of the auto industry that finally earned it national media attention?
I think in a short answer, yeah. You know, when I was working out west in Los Angeles for the New York Times, I quit. I wanted to come home. I wanted to raise my daughter here because I'm from here. And I pitched this to, you name it, to NPR, Time, Politico, Washington Post, on and on and on.
When was this?
Late 2007, and I told you, hey, man, I mean, something's really brewing. You can smell the housing market starting to collapse. We should go to the center of what really made America rich, which was its manufacturing heart, which was Detroit. And I couldn't get anybody to bite. The media, radio, or newspapers, or what have you, was consolidating, losing money, trying to figure out how to save itself, and nobody was interested in a boutique bureau in Detroit. Well, come about September 15th, when Lehman went bankrupt, boom, Everybody started flooding in. I started getting the calls from TV crews in Barcelona, from Moscow, from London, from Miami, you name it. And all of a sudden, everybody was interested in Detroit in a sense of, yeah, we know Detroit's a hellhole. Is it an outlier or is it the epicenter? Should we actually be paying attention instead of mocking it?
It's a reasonable question. What do you think?
My supposition is it's the epicenter. It was without a doubt the epicenter. If 50 years ago, over 30% of our economy was manufacturing, and you look at it today and it's about 10%, and you realize what we've done is we've lived on exotic scraps of paper, the bill came due, and we're all looking around realizing now, Jesus, you actually have to make things for there to be value in your dollar. Well, we don't. And now we're back to the scene of the crime.
You've said that, you know, a lot of lazy narratives, cookie cutter narratives, come out of the parachute journalism. What do you mean? Give me the standard narrative.
Urban gardening. There's one for you. Urban gardening. Urban gardening is going to be the future of Detroit. Is it really? Are we going to take the poisoned fields of Detroit with the mercury, with the lead, and actually grow corn and put 100,000 adults to work? I don't think so. I like gardens, too. Gardens are nice. But that's not what we should be focusing on. What we should be focusing on is, where's the money to the police department? What happened to the money going to the fire department? Why don't the ambulances show up on time?
And those stories aren't told?
No, they're not told.
How do you think Time magazine did when it came in for a year, rented a house, and tried to put down roots, at least temporarily, so that they would avoid the pitfalls of parachute journalism?
Well, I applaud them for trying, maybe to get to something here.
Did they?
No, not really. I think they were cowed a little bit because when you live here, you have pride. We are human beings, right? This is our community. But you shouldn't let local pride get in the way of illuminating where it is they actually live. And I think that they fell into that trap a little bit, which was you're not going to come in from the outside and say these things about us. Well, I think you can't worry about it. If you try to tell the truth and you're out there and you're hitting the blocks and you're digging through the paperwork, let the truth be its own justification. So I'm glad they did that. The Wall Street Journal is here. The Associated Press is here. Reuters, Bloomberg, there are people paying attention. So this isn't something unique to them. Having said that, I don't know what kind of appetite there is in the United States for do the ambulances work in Detroit. Having been a national correspondent, the trick is Detroit's its own special and unique place, but it is coming to you. It's coming to Phoenix. It's coming to Los Angeles, Dallas, Miami. There's a lot of misery, a lot of doubt, a lot of broken homes, a lot of shattered careers, and people are afraid. They're confused, and the zeitgeist is rage.
You've been in Detroit for 2 years. You've said that at first you were really overwhelmed and you fixated on the freak show stories. Explain what that means and how your reporting changed.
Well, I'll be honest with you. Look, it was amusing. And let me explain that. When you're a reporter, you are a leech. You find a host and you grab onto it and you drain it for all it's worth. Do you feel for the people? Of course you do. But you pack up your parachute, you pack up your charge card and your hangover, you get on the airplane, and you find the next pocket of misery. Well, it was interesting here, like, oh my God, can you believe this? Look at the city council. Look at the mayor. Look at these bozos running the car company. Wow. And then it's not funny anymore. Because one, you can't leave. You're from here. It's not funny because your brother just lost his house. It's not funny because there's a guy in an elevator shaft, frozen, and everybody left them there. Now you start to get angry and you realize this buffoonery, this corruption, it's killing people. So what happened to me was, for the first time in my life, I became that thing in college that I never was, which was, we can use this journalism as a force for good, an agent for change. I'm going to get to the bottom of this, and I want some accountability. So now I started going through paperwork. I never did that. Contracts. You know what I mean? I wanted an answer. Have I gotten one? Yeah. Can I fix it? No. But there is hope. You know what I learned here? Through these people I wrote about, these very, very good people, that our hope is in each other. Small little ways, small little efforts Can everybody send $5 to bury this kid? Can we all get together and force the police to catch this murderer? Can we ask a judge to man up and hold these people over for trial? Can we do that? And we are doing that.
That sounds like activism, which is great.
I know, it's weird. I know, it's weird.
But your story on Ayanna Stanley Jones serves as a record of the meaningless death of two kids. It's a story that demands outrage from its readers about the myriad ways Detroit's infrastructure is broken, graft and corruption leading to injustice and despair. But
and death.
And you raise the question yourself. Can your reporting change that, even a tiny little bit?
Yeah, let me go here. I am not an activist in the sense of what I'm doing. That's not what I mean. Look, here's a mirror. That's my job. Here's a mirror. Look at it. Look at it.
Charlie, thank you so much.
It's really been my pleasure.
Charlie LaDuff works for the Detroit News. His article, What Killed Ayanna Stanley Jones, was in the November-December issue of Mother Jones magazine.
Coming up, some fresh news about an old author and a very old war.
This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds working to maximize the effectiveness of charitable giving at fjc.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting unconventional approaches to transform health and healthcare at rwjf.org/pioneer. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with a few of your comments and an update. Our recent segment on whether public radio should continue to receive government money generated a torrent of viewpoints. Delta Leaper from Auburn Hills, Michigan, said that public funding wasn't worth the hassle. Quote, it's a tiny sliver of the federal budget, but gets way too much pressure from politicians on the right. It's also only a portion of the total funding for NPR. Why not give up the federal money and fund NPR entirely through listener contributions and sponsors?
And Michael from Pennsylvania agreed, quote, when you take public money, you accept all of the strings that politicians attach. NPR would be a lot better off walking away from the public trough. On the other side, some listeners took issue with our guest Nick Gillespie's argument that forcing conservatives to pay for NPR was akin to forcing taxpayers to pay for religions that they might not believe in. Mark Namark argued that, quote, tax deductions for religious groups mean that every taxpayer in America is forced to pay for other people's belief systems.
And this update. On Thursday, House Democrats voted down a Republican initiative to defund NPR. Virginia Republican Eric Cantor, soon to be House Majority Leader, said the vote showed that Democrats still don't get it. The tell-all book of the year recently debuted as number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list and is now available for your delectation. Among the words used to describe it are uncensored, shocking, a realer, darker twain. That's right, twain, as in Mark. Apparently, never this twain have we met until the publication of the Autobiography of Mark Twain, Volume 1. It's making news because the author slapped a century-long embargo on it. And finally, that time is up. But is it really such a sizzler or merely deft brand management from beyond the grave? Writer and Yale PhD candidate Craig Fairman recently quoted in Slate a letter that Twain wrote to his friend Walter Dean Howells in 1906. It goes, tomorrow I mean to dictate a chapter which will get my heirs and assigns burned alive if they venture to print it this side of AD 2006, which I judge they won't. There'll be lots of such chapters if I live 3 or 4 years longer. The edition of AD 2006 will make a stir when it comes out. Well, he did live 4 years longer, but really, Craig, what conceit! What accuracy?
You've got the prestigious literary magazine Granta hyping what they were calling the first exclusive excerpt from Twain's autobiography. You've also got the online blog Gawker talking about Twain's vibrating sex toy. So you've got the entire pop cultural spectrum really interested in this book.
Do you think it's at all remarkable that Twain seemed to foresee what kind of excitement his embargoed work would generate a century after his death?
Absolutely. Twain was brilliant at managing his brand. That's exactly what this idea gets at. Most writers don't want to sully their hands with that side of the business. Twain really innovated in that side of the business. When he first conceived the idea of the autobiography in his 30s, he thought that it would allow him to be more candid about both himself and about his various contemporaries, but he slowly started walking back this idea. He would write 50 years by some passages, as in don't print these for 50 years, 75 by others. So by keeping all these different dates in play and being playful with it, Twain gave both his editors and future literary executors permission to kind of play with this.
There was a financial element to all of this, wasn't there?
Oh, absolutely. Money was never far from Twain's mind when it came to the autobiography. I mentioned that he published a few things in his own lifetime. He took the proceeds from that and ended up building a new house, and for a while they called it the Autobiography House.
So how much of an embargo is this really? I mean, there were three previous editions of Twain's autobiography, one in 1924, one in 1940, one in 1959. How much is new in the 2010 version?
Well, in the first volume, only about 5% of the material is actually new. The next two volumes, which are about 5 years away, will have as much as 50% new material.
And what's in that 5%?
Well, there's all kinds of stuff. The Granta excerpt has Twain talking about a farm and reminiscing about his childhood days. He talks about Theodore Roosevelt and the way American soldiers are working abroad and the damage that they're doing.
Was he talking in this section about the Spanish-American War at the turn of the 20th century?
Right, and the idea that the American soldiers were, quote, uniformed assassins. That's the phrase he used. But again, that's a phrase that crops up in Twain biographies. It's not something that's being heard here for the first time.
There's a section that apparently his daughter, who was his executor for a long time, didn't want out. He's writing on Christianity, and he writes, "Ours is a terrible religion. The fleets of the world could swim in spacious comfort in the innocent blood it has spilled."
He was very willing to criticize organized religion.
But he only used such strong terms in the embargoed work.
Twain definitely saved his frankest and most damning passages for the embargo. His famous line in the preface was, "In this autobiography, I shall keep in mind that I am speaking from the grave. From thence I can speak freely."
Managing your brand posthumously.
I think one thing worth noting is that to manage your brand, you have to have a brand in the first place. And that's something that Twain was uniquely qualified to have. He was the kind of celebrity that would get noticed as he was walking the streets of New York. That celebrity, in addition to his writing, allowed him to package his life in a way that was unprecedented. Twain realized that good marketing doesn't just make money. Good marketing also ensures that you're being talked about. We've mentioned these three previous editions. They were not only bestsellers, but they also made front page news. And so these ensured not only that the Twain bottom line increased, but also that the Twain reputation increased.
"Oh, I'm always sorry to have my name mentioned as one of the great authors."
Actor Hal Holbrook doing Twain.
"Because they have such a sad habit of dying off. Chaucer is dead. So is Milton, and so is Shakespeare."
Tell me about how he wrote this work. I mean, a lot of this work wasn't actually written at all. It was dictated.
That's right. Twain experimented with this beginning in his 30s, trying to come up with different ways to do that. The method he finally settled on was through dictation. When Albert Payne came on to do Twain's biography, he needed raw material. And so Twain said, "Well, let's do dictations, but let me use the dictations themselves for my autobiography."
And this was something of a postmodern work. It wasn't chronological when he wrote it. It was more or less stream of consciousness.
Right. The writing of the autobiography can feel as modern as the marketing of the autobiography. There are nice little set pieces where he'll tell a story or an anecdote or expand on something at length, but then he'll jump forward decades or jump backward decades. This was the voice and the tone he wanted and hoped, although, again, you can never tell how serious he's being about this stuff. He hoped that this was a model that future autobiographers might consider.
Do you think that his current living, breathing publicists are overselling this a bit by calling it shocking?
I do. The image that everyone's trying to put out there is a realer, darker Twain, a Twain that we need now more than ever. I'm certainly not going to be disappointed that Twain's on the front page of the New York Times. It's a wonderful book, and I'm excited that it's going to be on shelves. But it's not exactly the mass market literary event that it's being portrayed to be.
Fundamentally, did it change your view of this very public man?
Honestly, no, because the raw materials have been processed by various biographers. Twain has had the benefit of more biographies than just about any other American literary figure. It was fun to read. It was nice to have. But the ideas themselves were already in the public conversation. And that's what makes this idea that we're getting the real Mark Twain finally so mystifying.
Well, Craig, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Craig Fairman is a Yale PhD candidate and freelance writer who recently wrote about Twain's autobiography in Slate.
Humor is nothing more than the good-natured side of the truth.
Actor McAvoy Lane doing Twain.
And laughter, without philosophy woven into it, is but a sneeze at humor. Genuine humor is replete with wisdom. And if a piece of humor is to last, it must do two things. It must teach, and it must preach. Not professedly. If it does those two things professedly, all is lost. But if it does them effectively, that piece of humor will last forever, which is 30 years.
Adam Goodhart, a historian and professor at Washington College, is the author of a blog called Disunion. Its subject, the American Civil War. Blogs, of course, are a great vehicle for tracking news and views in the moment, but the Civil War, for those who keep track of such things, has been over for nearly a century and a half. No matter. Goodhart says there's much to appreciate in blogging the war via newspaper accounts day by day. It enables us to experience it almost like contemporaries.
The way that people experience history is not a sort of a sweeping view from 500 miles up where you see armies marching across the landscape. The blog format, I think, lets people experience the history of the past one day at a time.
Something else you've never had to reckon with as a historian before was comments from readers.
People are refighting the old ideological battles of the 19th century in a way that Americans never seem to tire of doing. There seems to be a big movement to connect the Tea Party to the Confederacy.
How did the war change journalism?
Journalism changed the Civil War before the Civil War changed journalism. By 1860, by the time of Lincoln's election, every major newspaper in the country carried reports by telegraph. The telegraph and just the proliferation of the media in general really created sort of a national echo chamber that might be a little bit familiar to some people today. Compare the American Revolution to the Civil War. In 1775, there were 37 newspapers, and most of them were weekly newspapers. In 1860, there were 3,700 newspapers, and very many of them were daily newspapers. And much as in today's media environment, it rewarded the people who could be the most outrageous.
Give me an example.
Sure. Well, my favorite bit of invective that I came across in researching my book is an editor saying, "Lincoln is a cross between a sandhill crane and an Andalusian jackass." I'm not sure what he was trying to get across, but clearly it was not meant to be a compliment.
And it seems that accurate information was not the premium item here. It was more about emotion.
To some degree, it was about telling people what they wanted to hear. For instance, when the disaster at Bull Run occurred, many of the northern newspapers reported it initially as a great and glorious Union triumph. It was only later that the real reports started to trickle in about the Federals racing one another as fast as they could back towards Washington.
Talk about the racial sensitivity of the Civil War press.
Racial sensitivity?
Was there any?
No. Not only was there no racial sensitivity, but in fact, racism really was the sort of political currency of the times. Every issue of every newspaper practically was sprinkled with disgusting racial invective.
The North and South.
North and South. Well, of course, the Southerners were talking about Lincoln as the candidate of the Negro. Meanwhile, the Northerners were trying to prove that they didn't love Negroes any more than the Southerners did. The Republicans, in fact, all through Lincoln's Republican campaign in 1860, were going to great lengths to prove how racist they were. I kept finding references to the possibility of there eventually being a black president of the United States. Lincoln's opponents started asking, well, if this anti-slavery doctrine of the Republican Party is carried to its logical extreme, is that going to mean that we're going to have to grant black people full citizenship? One politician asked, will you allow them to sit at your own table, marry your daughters, sit in your halls of Congress, and perhaps be president of the United States? One other account that I found described a Democratic parade through the streets of Manhattan in 1860, and there were banners. One of the banners showed Abraham Lincoln embracing a black woman, and another one showed a sort of a stereotypical cartoon of an African American, and beneath it were the words, the successor of Abraham Lincoln in 1864. So this specter of a future black president was a scare tactic that was used repeatedly.
As you blog it day after day after day, and you see so much of the inaccurate reporting, do you see anything good here? Was the public at all served by the coverage of the day?
There's so much good to talk about. For one thing, I think the vividness of the reporting at that time was something that influenced public opinion perhaps even more than the rhetoric and the bombast. For instance, when John Brown was hanged in 1859 for his attempt to foment an insurgency of slaves in the South, this young correspondent named Ned House managed to get himself onto the scaffold standing right next to John Brown. He pretended that he was a medic who needed to be there with him. And so House was literally close enough that he could hear Brown's neck snap as he fell through the trap door. And he wrote an incredibly vivid description for Northern readers describing this body there kicking and struggling at the end of the rope. And this just brought the news home to Northerners in a way that they wouldn't have felt if they had just simply read a dispatch that said, John Brown was executed yesterday at Harper's Ferry, which is the way the news would have been reported 20 or 30 years before.
How sophisticated do you think the public was with regard to its media?
Well, I think people knew enough to be quite skeptical of the newspapers, especially as the war progressed. There were jokes that said the reason that some newspapers published morning editions and evening editions was so that the evening editions could contradict and retract everything that had been in the morning edition. And yet people were voracious, I think, in the way that readers of blogs are voracious today. There's a skepticism, but there's a human tendency that I think has perhaps always existed to want to be the first to know the most.
Mm-hmm. Newspapers then were conduits of emotionally inflected information as the events unfolded. What do you think they resembled more, blogs today or newspapers today?
I think the newspapers of the time were certainly, they would be familiar to anyone who looked at them today. They include what we would think of as news features. There are sports pages, there are financial pages in the newspapers of the 1860s. But I think the way that people spoke in the press was more similar to the way that people speak on blogs now. For instance, the Richmond Dispatch at the very beginning of the war said, "Let them come, those minions of the North. We will glut our carrion crows with their beastly carcasses. Yes, from the peaks of the Blue Ridge to the Tidewater, we will strew our plains and leave their bleaching bones to enrich our soil."
Yum.
I think part of what drove Americans to disunion in 1860 was the fact that for the first time, each side, each section of the country could hear what the other one was saying. And the Northerners heard this kind of invective from the South, and they said, my God, these Southerners aren't just simply protesting against certain policies. They can't just simply be coaxed with compromise back into the Union. They want to, as another newspaper said, let our accursed blood manure their fields.
As a historian, you take the long view. Do you sense that we're moving through a cycle? You know, divisive politics, divisive media.
Well, it's always very hard to say whether it's the divisive politics that are driving the divisive media or vice versa. We do have a lot of people in whose interest it is to whip up all kinds of public fervor on various issues, often based on misinformation or disinformation. And I think that's just what was going on in the 1850s and 1860s. I think the antidote to it is calm and responsible reporting. But as we learned in the 1860s, and as we're learning today, it can be very hard for those calm and measured voices to break through the din.
Adam, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Adam Goodhart is the author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening, which will be published in April. He's currently blogging the Civil War for the New York Times website.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Brett Jaspers, with more help from Nerida Brownlee. And it was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Dylan Keith.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs and our North Star. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.